Okay, we're back on TalkBack. 721-1290 is our number, 1-800-568-5309. And before we get Gabriel Scheinman on the phone, I'm going to embarrass the poor man by reading this wonderful bio, Bob, that you gave me. We appreciate that about our guest. Gabriel Scheinman, Director of the Policy, Jewish Policy Center, in addition to Director of Policy, he's also a PhD candidate in international relations at Georgetown University, where his dissertation focuses on alliances. He's a contributing analyst at Wikistrat, and for the past 5 years has served as research associate to the Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's a Rumsfeld Graduate Fellow. Was visiting fellow at the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. His publications have appeared in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, American Interest, the National Interest, the Washington Quarterly, Time.com, the Jerusalem Post, and of course, now the feather in his cap, he's on TalkBack in Missoula, Montana.
I'm sure that'll be first on the list now.
This is a resume builder game.
I'll change it the second I get.
And he's also now going to be an expert on international indecent exposure law.
First of all, welcome to Missoula, Montana, sir. It's a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's give the audience a little background. I was reading Real Clear Politics for those out there that have an interest. Is a wonderful place to catch up on the domestic and global news. And this title caught my attention, and it was about Israel and terrorism in North African countries primarily, or as we say here in the United States with our administration, insurgencies. So I
random acts of violence, I think,
random
is what
acts
we're
of violence.
Moving towards.
So I was reading this article, and I thought, well, this is quite interesting and something probably the audience has not been exposed to. And I had read this, of course, and there was Gabe's a name and background. Reached out to him, and that's why he's here on the show today. So, Gabe, maybe we could just start with first, give us a little insight into the Jewish Policy Center in terms of what do you do, what does the center represent?
Sure, absolutely. And like I said, thank you all very much for having me on. The Jewish Policy Center, we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. And our goal is really to educate both our, backwards facing and frontwards facing. So frontwards facing is the U.S. government. I mean, we're literally four blocks from Capitol Hill. And backwards facing is to educate our members and that large, the Jewish community, about issues of importance to the United States, generally on foreign affairs, but on domestic affairs as well. So in that sense, we're very strong supporters of a strong American defense capability, strong U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and as well as a very internationalist American engagement abroad. In terms of the stuff we produce, our flagship publication is a quarterly magazine called In Focus, and I'm happy to send you guys and send anybody else listening some copies. It's a quarterly magazine that is each thematic. So our most recent issue was on some of the domestic challenges facing the new Congress, but the issue before that was on Europe 25 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall and taking some sort of different alternative takes on what's going on in Europe. So, whether Finlandization or neutrality is a good idea for Ukraine or why anti-Semitism in Italy and Spain is actually less than in other places, and as well as sort of the rise of some of the Islamic extremism that you have across the continent, obviously most shockingly seen in Paris about a month ago. So in addition to that, myself and colleagues here, we write a lot of articles and analyses, hoping to get our viewpoints across.
So Gabe, we'll come back to that a little bit later in terms of people that may have some interest. Let's go to the article that caught my attention in the first place. So give us some background about what brought you to that and the research that you did, and, of course, that led to the article.
Sure. So the article Bob's referring to is I titled Israel, an Asset for Africa. And the plug or the hook is that if you go back to the big rally of world leaders in Paris after the terrorist attacks in Paris about a month ago, you had in the front line of those leaders, in addition to the President of France, Chancellor of Germany, and Prime Minister of Italy, Prime Minister Cameron of Britain, I mean, noticeably absent was our president, but in the front line you had the Prime Minister of Israel, and he was locked arm in arm with the President of Mali, who was the sole African leader actually in the front row. And he's there because he was very close and very thankful for the French military intervention that is still ongoing but started about a year and a half ago in Mali to basically fight back an Islamic insurgency. But the more interesting part is that Israel and Mali don't have diplomatic relations. And yet here you have in the front row the leaders of both countries walking arm in arm, united against terrorism, united in support of free speech. And it's a very interesting situation. And so you dig back a little bit and you try to understand is why exactly would a, you know, in this case, a West African Muslim leader lock arm in arms with an Israeli leader with whom he doesn't even have relations with. And to go back, you understand is that to dig a little further back in terms of Israeli-African relations is that in the early days of the State of Israel, in the 50s and even 60s, Israel actually had excellent relations with all of sub-Saharan Africa, even the Muslim countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Israelis were very advanced in agricultural technology, environmental technology, which was very much in demand. And in the late 60s and 70s, that started to shift as a lot of these countries came under pressure from some of the Arab countries through the use of oil. We all remember in 1973 the Arab oil embargo based on partly the U.S. support for Israel during the 1973 Yom Kippur War, but that started a lot earlier, and they basically pressured a lot of these countries who were energy deprived that in return for cheap oil that they should follow the Arab line in foreign policy, which at the time was basically rejecting Israel's right to exist, you know, Israel's existence writ large, etc. After the fall, and that was buttressed by the Soviet Union, after the fall of the Soviet Union in the 90s, that started to shift again, and you had all of a sudden all these countries who no longer were receiving support from the Soviet Union or cheap oil from their Arab neighbors who reopened to Israel. And from the 90s and even to the early 2000s, most countries in sub-Saharan Africa reestablished relations with Israel. And post 9/11 and more recently, you have a lot of these countries who are starting to face, whether you want to call it terrorism or insurgencies, whatever you would like to call it, starting to face these issues across the board, especially in the Sahel belt, which is sort of the geographical dividing line between the North African Arab North and the, you know, sub-Saharan African rest of the continent. And you have them starting to value Israel as a world leader in anti-terrorism, whether it's Nigeria, whether it's Rwanda, whether it's Mali, whether it's Senegal, whether it's a bunch of host countries. And so, you know, who knows if anything in particular will come out of that front line locked arms between these two leaders. Maybe Mali is one of... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are being said here, and we're going to have to go to a break here shortly. But first, was that purposeful in terms of Netanyahu winding up arm in arm? Because was Netanyahu actually invited to participate in that? Because I thought there was some controversy about this. And secondly, when we come back from the break, it is possible, and this is one of the things being said here in the U.S., that not to generalize about the Islamic world, that your point is Israel had relations with many Islamic countries, that this really seems to be a focus of the issue of the Middle East, Palestinians in terms of the Arab-Islamic type of, you know, problems as opposed to Islam in general in Israel. So when we come back, let's elaborate on that a little bit and have you give us some insight.
Okay, we have two lines open as well. If you want to visit with Gabe Scheinman, you have a question or a comment, the lines are open at 721-1290. We'll be right back. Hey, we're back on Talkback. It's Wednesday, February 11th. That's John King over there, Bob Seidenschwartz in studio with us from the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. Joining us on the telephone from Washington, D.C., Director of Policy, Jewish Policy Center, Gabe Scheinman. And so you just asked a couple of questions before the break, Bob.
Yeah, Gabe, there's something here that you had said which is very important, which is Israel in the past and in the present has had very good relationships with various Islamic countries, and in some cases, maybe even their neighbors. So the distinction between Islam and the Middle East Arab countries, of which that has been a difficult relationship, has not always been the case. So it's not mutually incompatible for this country and Islam to get along, if you want to give a little bit more insight to that.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right that both in the past and now, even Israel has had some excellent relationships with countries that are Muslim majority countries. I wouldn't necessarily call them Islamic countries in that same way, because there's a difference between countries that follow or attempt to follow Islamic law that we would call sort of countries or Islamist political ideologies versus those that happen to be majority Muslim but follow a largely secular path. So, for example, even Iran, during the time of the Shah, before this current regime, you know, basically took over 35 years ago, Iran and Israel had excellent relations, and Iran even supplied Israel with oil, and it was, and there's some great movies about how many Israelis were living in Tehran at the time for the first 35 years of Israel's existence. Israel and Turkey, even though now relations are awful, they still have relations, and there were close military ties in the past. Obviously, today Israel has peace treaties with both Egypt and Jordan, both of whom there's a lot of very close coordination with, and like you said, both in the past, in the 50s and 60s, and now again with a number of Muslim majority African countries. So, and even things we don't even think about, things like in Europe, a small country like Albania, who's a member of the Organization of Islamic Conference, a Muslim majority country, Israel has also very good relations with. So it's not necessarily antithetical. They aren't necessarily antithetical to each other. But the radical Islamist ideology that we do see both in a lot across the Muslim world that's gaining prominence, and including at the head of certain countries like Iran and others, that is antithetical to Israel. But it's certainly not Muslims as a whole, any stretch of the imagination.
One of the other articles that I had picked up on of yours dealt with the kind of the rise of the minority, or the majority of the minorities in the Middle East. And you're kind of discussing how maybe America should have a foreign policy shift away from kind of the Arab-Sunni coalition towards a bunch of these minority groups that are in the region. Can you kind of take us down that road a little bit?
Sure. And there's two parts to it. One is, what does the region actually look like? And the other is, what is the history of American foreign policy towards that? So the first part is that in our mindset, we sort of assume that the Middle East, which even in and of itself, there's a lot of definitions of, but broadly speaking, from Morocco all the way on the Atlantic coast of the Mediterranean, all the way east to Iran, in our heads, everybody's kind of Arab, and everybody, an ethnic identity, and everybody's Muslim, a religious identity. But the truth is that one of the amazing things about the Middle East is that it really is the cradle of civilization. And as a consequence, you have so many other types of both ethnic and or religious minorities. So on the ethnic side, it's not everybody's Arab. Some are Turk, some are Kurdish, some are Persian, some are, the list goes on. And on the religious side, not only are there big divisions within Islam, but there are non-monotheist religions, not even non-Christian, non-Jewish, non-Islamic religions that still exist, such as Yazidis, who kind of came into prominence last summer when they were under siege by Islamic militants in Iraq and in Syria, or Zoroastrians, or Chaldeans, or there's a bunch of others like that. So if you actually look at the Middle East as a whole, it's not such as monolithic culturally as we make it out to be.
One of the easiest things for me to, when I'm trying to explain that, is just to explain to people that the term Aryan, which became popular under Nazism, right, for the blonde hair, blue-eyed kind of look, the same root word is the root word for Iran.
Yeah, and at the time, certainly the Shah, 35 years ago, the previous regime in Iran, certainly tried to play that up a little bit to demonstrate that, Iran was a sophisticated European-like country, and tried to in many ways separate. The same thing was the regime that created the modern state of Turkey about 100 years ago, same thing, the Ataturk, as we call him, also tried to portray Turkey into a European country devoid of its kind of Middle Eastern roots as a way of modernizing the country. So
this is Peter. Now, I've been listening to what you've been saying, and what I hear, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that Israel seems to have a very good working relationship with governments or with peoples, rather, who may be Islamic, but yes, not necessarily are theocracies. Is that what I hear you saying?
I wouldn't quite put it that far in the sense that it has a good working relationship, but there's a lot more, I'll put it this way, there's a lot more opportunity for future cooperation. So just to give one specific example that's been in the news a lot is the plight of the Kurdish people. The Kurdish people is not something that makes a lot of news in the United States. There's about 25 to 40 million Kurds that are spread over four states, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Iran, and they themselves are stateless. But ever for the last 10 years, ever since the war in Iraq, and but even going back a little bit further, northern Iraq has been sort of a Kurdish self-governing zone, and that has really sped up Kurdish efforts. Now, Kurdish statehood is opposed by those four countries for the obvious reasons that they would be losing territory to their own, from their own people to someone else. But Netanyahu, 6 months ago or so, was the first foreign leader to call for a Kurdish state. Because the Kurds, and I've spent some time there myself, they're very philo-Semitic. I mean, you talk about what kind of relationship they'd like to have with America, they would say, like the relationship Israel has with America. They see a small state besieged on all sides that wants to be a modern, liberal state and join the Western world.
Okay,
their issue is a little bit more complicated. They're surrounded all sides by hostile states to them, as opposed to Israel, which at least is on the sea and can have access to Europe and Asia and so
right.
forth. But it's a very interesting thing that goes below the radar.
Okay, we're up against another break. We're going to come right back. We have two lines open. Gabe Scheinman joining us, Director of Policy, Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back. This is Talk Back. And it's Wednesday, February 11th. Montana World Affairs Council on the radio, Bob Seidenschwartz, John King. I'm Peter Christian. Joining us, Gabe Scheinman, Director of Policy, Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen?
Yeah, well, Bob, you were teasing a question right before the break.
Yeah, I love this stuff. I mean, you know, to kind of get into the weeds with this. You had mentioned that Netanyahu, and I would assume by proxy Israel, has made statements favorable to some type of Kurdish state, which is in direct contrast to U.S. policy in terms of us saying anything in that way. And Gabe, could you kind of give us some insight, of course, to U.S. policy in that area as relates to the Kurds? And, of course, why does Netanyahu make these kind of statements and support this?
Sure. I mean, it's first, the mega point, regardless of whether it's this administration or any other, is that the United States is not in the business of redrawing the borders of other states. And if it started to do so and started to advocate on behalf of, you know, chopping and cutting and redrawing and things like that, in many ways it's a slippery slope. It's an international system that's going back over 400 years in terms of the inviolability of state borders and the issues of sovereignty. So there's a very mega philosophical issue. On the more specific issue of that issue in that region is that we think we have very good relations with a bunch of states in the area. Turkey, where there's the largest Kurdish population and would stand to lose the most chunk of territory if you followed it along ethnic lines, is a NATO ally, even if it doesn't act like one today, but is a NATO ally. Iraq, I mean, the U.S. forces are fighting in Iraq today, you know, and obviously had been for 10 years and going back 20 years. So all the blood and treasure that we've pumped into it to essentially keep Iraq together is not something the president wants to shoot out the window. Although, interestingly enough, Vice President Biden, going back to when he was in the Senate and at the some of the worst moments of the Iraq War, actually supported a soft partition plan in Iraq that would see Iraq split into three states, you know, a Shiite southern state, a Sunni western state, and a Kurdish northern state. So the ideas have been there for a long time. It just takes a lot to kind of cross that threshold for the U.S. to basically rip up its policy of, I mean, going back a long time, upsetting its ally, you know, in Baghdad, Iraq, its ally in Turkey, you know, Syria may be less important today. And also on the Iranian front, today, you know, the president's gambit to try and restore a functioning relationship with Iran after 35 years, I mean, that would probably go to shreds almost overnight if the president started calling for Iran to cede territory to another minority. So there's a lot of complicated things in there.
What does the Jewish Policy Center think?
We don't take a policy on any. No, we don't. It's not our policy. I mean, I can tell you my personal opinion, but at the end of the day, it's actually not even that. The question is, are we preventing something? Or, you know, what are the trend lines in history? And if you look at what the Kurds are doing on themselves, is that they're really building a state. If you spend time there, other than the currency and what goes up on the flag,
and we're up against,
you know that you were in Iraq.
Okay, well, we're up against our break. We'll be back at the top of the hour, continuing with the Montana World Affairs Council.
Hey, thanks for hanging out with us this morning. This is John King. I'm filling Peter's shoes while he goes to cover a police story. Actually, I think he's down at the Sheriff's Department right now. But in the interim, we've got Gabe Scheinman on the air with us today. He's from the Jewish Policy Center, where he is the Director of Policy. So we'll be talking a lot about, you know, U.S. relations with Israel, Israel's relationship with other countries, and He's a specialist, if I don't misunderstand, he's a specialist when it comes to alliances between various countries. And so I'd like to dig in here shortly to talk a little bit about this whole spat between the U.S. and what appears to be a difficulty with Bibi Netanyahu. We've got the House of Representatives trying to invite him. We've got the president trying to disinvite him. What's your take on all this, Gabe?
How something like this can dominate the headlines for 2 weeks or going on 2 weeks now. Look, it's a tricky issue. I mean, the administration is basically shunning the leader of its closest allies because it says that, you know, it doesn't want to give. Israeli elections are scheduled for 2 weeks after Netanyahu's speech to Congress. So then the administration is concerned about giving Netanyahu a platform in which he can boost his reelection chances. In Congress itself, you have a number of congressional Democrats that have said that they're going to boycott the speech because they don't like that the House Republicans have turned Israel into a partisan issue. And at the end of the day, the Prime Minister of Israel, all he's saying is that I disagree with the president's Iran policy and I want to talk about it. So there's a lot of stuff going on. I think the key thing to actually talk about here is that you have a fundamental difference between the American administration and the Israeli government over what to do about Iran. I mean, that to me is the crux of it, and I think people are not talking about it as much.
So a lot of people haven't probably been following this that closely. Let me give you my layman's. This is, you know, kind of cursory reading of the news. From what I can see, the U.S. is in kind of negotiations with Iran. And these negotiations kind of would open Iran up to the world in a little bit more of a way than it has been in the past. And Israel is deathly afraid of that and does not like that move. Because they have been threatened over and over and again by Iran. So what is the basic position for the U.S. and Israel, and have I got any of it right?
You definitely have the overview absolutely right. I mean, it's the negotiations themselves are theoretically limited to the issue of Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons.
Okay.
But I think both the administration wants to, and the Israeli government is afraid that they will be these nuclear negotiations will be used as the first step to a normalized relationship between the U.S. and Iran. I don't quite want to go so far as to call it a partnership, but to some sort of coordinated understanding about the region as a whole. Even to the point that the administration seems to have changed its policy with regards to Syria in order to not upset the nuclear negotiations. So the nuclear part is almost like the bait and switch that can go into something deeper. On the nuclear issue itself, the administration shares Israel's long-term goal that it is acting to prevent an Iranian nuclear weapon. The problem is if you parse down each of those words, the difference between the two positions, between the two countries, is vast. And basically the Israelis are concerned about that the administration is ready to sign any deal with Iran, that any deal is better than no deal, whereas the Israeli position is that no deal is better than a bad deal.
Now, is Israel that wrong to think that? I mean, we watch what happened in Cuba. It does seem like this administration is open to just starting conversations in any old way.
Yeah, I mean, again, the Israeli position is not that it doesn't want the administration, and it's not just the administration, by the way. It's the three major European powers and China and Russia who are involved in these negotiations. But the Israeli position is not that there shouldn't be any negotiation or any talking. But at the end of the day, the Iranian regime cannot be trusted. It has cheated on its nuclear commitments going back 10 years. It continues even to cheat on some of the issues it agreed to during this interim deal that has been in existence for 18 months. And writ large, it is the largest nefarious actor in the region, supporting terrorism, supporting Assad. You know, we talk about foreign fighters going into Syria to fight on behalf of the rebels in the Islamic State. We tend to exclude all the Iranians and Iraqi Shiites and Lebanese Shiites that have poured in to fight on behalf of the Assad regime. I mean, they're everywhere. Hmm. So the question is, and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger testified before Congress the other day and actually said it very well, which is that the administration talked about these negotiations as the method with which to basically end or dismantle Iran's nuclear capability. And now it seems like the negotiations actually have to do with what is the scope of Iran's nuclear capability. And so Israel is deathly concerned that the administration is acting to legitimize an Iranian nuclear capability at even a pretty good level and one that will come back to haunt them in the future.
So, Gabe, please comment on this. Some very seasoned negotiators in policy have made the comment that while not in disagreement with what the attempt of the outcome is, but have really called the administration amateurish in terms of their approach and methodology. And in effect, we're saying they've already given away and lost many key elements of negotiation. So from purely a policy negotiation perspective, can you shed a little bit of light on this? And are they accurate to say that you know, they've already lost half the battle in terms of what they've done?
No, look, I unfortunately agree with the critics. You know, negotiations are a means to an end. If you can't accomplish that end, then maybe they are not the best means. And the logic behind these negotiations, which is that the sanctions that the world, honestly, had put on Iran in the years leading up to it, had established leverage. And like any negotiation, in order to have a better sense of what you want to achieve, the more leverage you can establish, the better. And the idea was to force the Iranian regime to choose. Does it want nuclear weapons, or does it want a healthy economy, relations with the world, normalization with the West?
Wow.
The way the deal is being rumored, and again, the negotiations are coming to a point, but you know, it's rumors and leaks that we know about. It seems like the administration is not making them make that choice.
Hey, Gabe, we got to go to a break. Give us a call at 721-1290 if you want to get in on the conversation. We've got Dave on the line. We have one line open for you. That's 721-1290. We'll be back right after this quick break. All right, a little Doobie Brothers to bring us back into the show. This is John King. You're listening to Talk Back. We got Bob Seidenschwartz in studio, and on the line we have Gabe Scheinman. He is the director of policy at the Jewish Policy Institute, Center. And one of the things that was brought up right before the break, and we were talking off air about it a little bit, was the issue of negotiations with Iran. And Gabe was kind of drawing the parallel with negotiations in the past with North Korea, which also a fan favorite for the United States, right? so tell us, give us the, what's compare and contrast?
Well, first of all, you have actually a lot of the same people. And this is key in any administration, but a lot of the people that work for the Clinton administration naturally, you know, 10 years later, you know, get bumped up a level and work for the Obama administration. So the lead negotiator for us on the Iran nuclear talks, Wendy Sherman, was one of the key people involved in the North Korea talks. So The personnel is the same, and people generally, you know, even us, don't like to admit when we're wrong and change our views on things. So part of it is that, but part of it also is, regardless of the best intentions of our negotiators in the talks, part of it also comes from the White House and the leverage that we've given up. You know, the president, even though he says all options are on the table, between cutting defense spending, between withdrawing our forces, between our bad relationships with a bunch of Middle Eastern allies, not just Israel, but has basically taken the military option off the table from Iran's point of view. And combine that with the fact that we're willing to engage in seemingly endless negotiations. I mean, if a deal is possible, what's taking 18 months? Those two combinations make it so that the Iranians come into the negotiations knowing that the United States is more desperate for a deal than Iran is. And that hangs over the negotiations, no matter what the best intentions of our actual negotiators.
All right, let's go to our phone call. We've got, it's Dave on the line. Dave, thanks for joining us this morning. How are you doing, sir?
Yeah, good morning. I'm fine. From what I can see, we have two different agreements here. The Israelis believe that the Iranians should not have any nuclear program at all, because that would be, they can't be trusted. You know, like the Israelis who actually illegally develop nuclear bombs. So, and I can understand that position. But, and the administration believes that a nuclear program can exist without nuclear bombs. And I'm not sure which is the truth there. But as far as destroying the Iranian program, it would require probably an invasion or a nuclear attack.
Well, I think it's also important to talk about why there's a lack of trust, right? There's a difference between coming up to Bob, who's never had any, as far as I know, criminal record, and saying, hey, you're hanging out with some kids, that's fine. And then going up to someone that's sexually assaulted a kid and notice that they're hanging out with kids. There's a big difference, right? When you find out that Iran has secretly developed a nuclear network underneath a mountain in secret to create fissionable material, right? That kind of triggers a little bit of alarm.
Right. It's just like when Israel suddenly, developed their nuclear bombs. it was all secret and it was illegal.
Well, the difference is they weren't saying they were going to use it against a particular country.
Well, I mean, everyone says that.
No, they don't. Iran actually does exactly the opposite and says they will use it.
Well, the United States
says
just
we won't.
Just to
jump in on one
the
point,
Russians
actually,
say they will
there's
use
also
it.
Another difference in addition to the how responsible the different states are, is that Israel's development of nuclear weapons actually wasn't illegal. Israel is one of the few countries that hasn't signed up to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
So
in many cases, there's actually no... Israel is not bound by any specific international law that it has signed that said what it did was wrong. That's very different from Iran, which is a member of this treaty, and that the treaty has found it, Iran, in violation of its commitments. So even by the standards Iran judges itself by, what it's doing has been basically just violating a series of commitments. So there's another distinction there, too.
Right, but they did. Israel did develop it secretly. They didn't. They still don't admit they have them.
That's true, as far as I know, but just doing something in secret doesn't mean it's wrong, right?
Right. But I was wondering what his view on settlements were and the Palestinian state. I mean, I'm curious to know what his view on that is.
Big topic shift. All right, let's hear it.
Yes.
Yeah, all right. So, I mean, it's... you know, I think for everybody out there, as usual with these things, that you need some context to the overall questions, but... you know, what we refer to as settlements is essentially Israeli construction in areas that it conquered in the 1967 war. And the truth is, from my perspective, is that they aren't, are they a issue between Israelis and Palestinians when it comes to some sort of final agreement? Of course. Are they the issue? I don't think so. I mean, both Palestinian and Arab attacks on Israel existed long before, you know, settlements even came into being. I mean, that's why there was wars in 67 and 56 and 48 and terrorism going way back before that.
Well, the settlements themselves are the result of a war that they lost.
Right. For starters. And the other thing is, if you actually look at the disposition of settlements on the map, exactly where they are, and again, I don't have the exact percentage on me, but it's something like 85% or 90% of the settlers are on basically 8 or 9% of the West Bank. And so even in, you know, even if in a two-state solution along the so-called 67 lines, which I don't think is, you know, feasible anywhere in the near or medium-term future, even with the best of intentions, you know, it's not creating new realities on the ground in the way that it's played up in the international media. So, you know, if the true difference between Israelis and Palestinians is where Israelis build, you know, schools and synagogues and apartments and things like that, then if that's really the true difference, then there would have been peace a long time ago. But the reason there isn't a peace and the reason there isn't a Palestinian state has a lot to do with the self-defeating actions Palestinian leaders and Palestinian people have taken for going back several decades.
Well, you only have about 30 seconds left. Dave, did you have another question?
Yeah, if Israel decides to make it a one state and access all the West Bank into their country, wouldn't they have to allow the Palestinians the right to vote and what have you, and eliminate the...
Palestinians do have the right to vote
if you are an Israeli citizen.
Yes.
Not a Palestinian living in the West Bank or Gaza.
I'm talking about the land Israel conquered recently on the West Bank in 67. If they turn that into their own country, they would have to allow the Palestinians on the West Bank a chance to vote.
I'm going to have to get Gabe's response after the break here. We're going to a break. We'll be right back. We have one line open, 721-1290. Dave, I'll keep you on the air to respond, okay?
Okay.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, we're back on TalkBack, speaking with Gabe Scheinman from the Jewish Policy Center, and we also have Dave on the line, and I believe as we were transitioning out there, we were discussing a hypothetical, what would happen to Palestinians and whether or not they'd be able to vote in a future where Israel actually made the West Bank and other areas that they occupy as part of the Israeli state proper.
So, yeah, Dave, sure. So, I mean...
Go ahead, Gabe.
I mean, the first thing to remember is that Palestinians do have a right to vote. You know, even Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza vote for their leadership, and they have since the Oslo Accords, so going back 20 years now. And so when we talk about the president of the Palestinian Authority, you know, Mahmoud Abbas, is that he is elected by Palestinians. There's a Palestinian legislature. It's unfortunate, but it's the truth that about 9 years ago, Palestinians voted in what all intents is a free and fair democratic election for Hamas, you know, an internationally recognized terrorist group. So for starters, the Palestinians do have a right to vote as existing. I don't think that Israel has any plans whatsoever to annex the entire West Bank, but those Israeli politicians who argue for either total annexation or partial annexation talk about very openly that, therefore, the Palestinian individuals who live in those areas would be granted Israeli citizenship and would have the full right to vote and all other rights, just like Israeli Arabs, Arabs who currently have Israeli citizenship. So from a democratic and liberal perspective, you know, I don't think Israel is anywhere close to even thinking about treating people differently in that sense.
Whether it's a wise thing to do or not,
that's a separate question.
Can I comment?
Yeah, real quick.
Okay, about the Iran thing, to jump back there, our chairman of Joint Chief of Staff has said publicly that military option of bombing Iran would not eliminate their nuclear program. And I'm not sure what the other alternative would be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to bomb a program that's built underneath a mountain, I believe, right? So Gabe, what would be the tactic? What do you think? Which country has it right, and how do you stop nuclear proliferation and an Iranian?
I mean, I'm no military analyst, so it's hard for me to But on the operational level, it's hard for me, and frankly, for I think anybody who hasn't really done all the operational plan, the contingency planning, to really know, you know, how many sites do you have to hit? How do you have to hit them? What are the repercussions? What assets do you have to bring to bear? What's the response? I mean, there's a whole calculation to go down that road. Mm-hmm. I think the United States and Israel and anybody who's concerned about Iranian nuclear proliferation, we would all much prefer that, you know, the Iranian quest for nuclear bomb is stopped totally peacefully. You know, I think that there's a certain logic out there to be able to try and bring economic, political, diplomatic pressure to bear in order to make Iran have to choose. Does it care about its nuclear program, or does it care about the well-being of its citizens? You know, and one of the arguments that the administration will use, and I think there's some merit to it, of course, is that the sanctions, what really worries the supreme leader in Iran is not necessarily an attack from the United States or others, but it's a revolution from within. And you saw it a few years ago, if people remember, the Green Movement, where there was a sort of spontaneous protest of Iranians across the country based on what it saw was a fraudulent presidential election in 2009. That is what the Supreme Leader worries about the most. And if the economic situation was getting worse as a result of the sanction, if Iranians were starting to blame their leadership for it, then that is a greater threat to the leader than anything else.
So Gabe, I believe that is...
I think he needs to reestablish a lot of the leverage that we've given up over the last year and a half.
Gabe, there's a couple of things I want to go back to. We were talking about off air, but you just said something that I think is at the heart of the administration's policy is their belief that going forward, by taking the tack that they are, that a revolution or a change of the old guard and a entering into the global community is what they're hoping for in terms of that next generation. And is that a legitimate policy based on historic and present to even stand on with that expectation?
I mean, the truth is, and I'm not trying to be coy, the truth is we just don't know. Yeah. I mean, we often talk about, both on the right and the left, about how the Iranian people are pro-Western and they're sick of this clerical regime and all they want to do is, restore their prestige and rejoin the international community. But... there's still thousands in the street at rallies who chant death to Israel, death to the United States. Hmm. Even the Green Movement that I was referring to that was trying to support a couple of these presidential candidates who have since been put on house arrest and all these things, the official policy of that movement was full support of the nuclear program. Hmm. So it's hard to really know, and you can't really pull these things because ordinary people are deathly afraid of the regime. And so when American pollster or someone calls them on the phone and starts asking them political questions, they're not going to tell the truth for fear of their own life. So it's hard to tell what the actual Iranian people think about this. At the end of the day, you know, as much as we would love to, you know, help this, what matters to us is what are American interests and how do we go about achieving them.
All right, we've got another break coming up here. When we get back, I was watching the interviews with the, it was, I think, AP's Matt Lee and State Department Representative Jen Psaki. I also watched some clips with Josh Earnest the other day. And they were, I'm not a Jewish guy, just regular yokel from like Scotland originally. So when it comes to this issue, though, I was like pained watching them do backflips to not talk about the terror events in Paris as targeting Jewish people. It just seemed
just
so
happened to be
obvious.
A deli that they ran into,
right?
And a kosher deli, just pure happenstance.
It was
right?
It was a random act of violence.
Right.
Okay, so anyway, that was a quote from the president's interview with Vox, and so I want to play this clip and I want to get Gabe's reaction to it. Right after the break, we'll be back in just a second. Give us a call at 721-1290. All right, we're back on Talk Back. This is John King. We're speaking with Gabe Scheinman, Director of Policy at the Jewish Policy Center. And I had kind of briefed before the break that I wanted to bring up this the issue of the State Department. And the current administration has had difficulty at times kind of phrasing the way that they want to approach the issue of terror internationally. Over and over and again, they've been pressed to describe it as Islamic terror, and they will back away from that every time. But another thing that came up was in a recent interview with some of the staff over at Vox, the president said that there were events in Paris that were random acts of violence.
Great.
And, you know, anyone that remembers the event, right, there was a hostage taken and a situation in a kosher deli in Paris. And this is the way that the State Department is talking about it, or not talking about it, if you will. I'm going to play this for you, and I wanted to get Gabe's response. So here we go. Oh. Dave Peter forgot to teach me how to push the right button. There we go.
Yesterday, the president in his news conference raised some eyebrows by saying that the victims of the shooting in Paris at the kosher deli were random. Your colleague at the White House has apparently said something similar today. Is that really? Does the administration really believe that these people, that the victims of this attack were not singled out because they were of a particular faith?
Well, as you know, I believe, if I remember the victims specifically, there were not all victims of one background or one nationality. So I think what they mean by that is, I don't know that they spoke to the targeting of the grocery store or that specifically, but the individuals who were impacted.
Well, I mean, right, but when the secretary went and paid respects to it, he was with a member of the Jewish community there.
Naturally, given that is the grocery store is one that...
Well, don't you think that the target, maybe even if all the victims, even if the victims came from different backgrounds or different religions, different nationalities, wasn't the store itself was the target? Was it not?
But I mean, that's different than the individuals being. I don't have any more to.
All right. Well, does the administration believe that this was an anti-Jewish or an attack on the Jewish community in Paris?
I don't think we're going to speak on behalf of French authorities and what they believe was the situation at play here.
Yeah, but if a guy goes into a kosher market and starts shooting it up, he's not looking for Buddhists, is he?
Well, again, Matt, I think it's relevant that obviously the individuals in there who were shopping and working at the store.
Who does the administration expect shops at a kosher? I mean, I might, but, you know, an attacker going into a store that is clearly identified as being one of, you know, as identified with one specific faith, I'm not sure I can understand how it is that you can't say that this was a. This was a targeted
I just don't have more for government. You, Matt. It's an issue for the French government to address.
All right. What do you think, Gabe? What's the angle here?
Well, first of all, just so you know, Matt Lee, who's the reporter in the State Department clip from the AP, should win an Emmy because he's you could watch the funniest 20 minutes of television every day is when he needles the State Department spokesperson over language, and you really should watch it every day. That's first. But look, the issue is, you know, the issue is the president, in my opinion, the president clearly misspoke, but his aides and spokespeople, rather than just say, you know, the president, it was an interview, he's speaking quickly, clearly we think it's an anti-Semitic event, clearly we think that Jews were targeted, they tried to defend their boss in a very contorted way and had to kind of walk it back a lot later.
Let me ask you this, though. You see it as a defense of a mistake. But how do you know it's not the framing of the policy or the way that they want to approach the issue?
This is where I was. This is my next sentence, which is that, you know, on the one hand, I do think it was a mistake, but the problem is that over the last 6 years, the administration has done gymnastics with the English language to try and explain away these things. So if you remember, back in 2009, the Fort Hood terrorist attack, both in Nidal Hassan in Texas, well, at first they called that workplace violence. If you remember, they no longer use the word war on terrorism or war on Islamic extremism. They call it violent extremism. I think they even called another thing something like a man-made disaster as opposed to like natural disaster, things like that. So, you know, the problem is the shred of doubt where this comes from is that the administration has had a policy to try and downplay, violent, attacks from Islamic purists or Islamic militants.
So, Gabe,
so that's where I think a lot of it happens.
So having said that, though, please share your opinion and views as to why, though. Why have they gone to such efforts to make sure that their language and their context is as you just described? Because I think that's a question that I get that quite frequently, and I think the audience would really like to know what's the benefit of this type of policy.
Oh, hold on. We'll have to get that after the break. We got another one. It does time flies fast, doesn't it? All right, we'll be back right after this quick break. I promise it'll be quick. All right, we're back on the Talk Back Show. We have Gabe Scheinman from the Jewish Policy Center on the line. We also have Bob Seidenschwartz and intern Eric in studio helping with the phones. If you have a call, give us a ring at 721-1290. We'll get you on the air with Gabe. And right before the break, Bob, you were pushing for kind of an explanation of what the American foreign policy stance is and if it's been working on this front.
Well, this goes back to what Gabe was saying, and I'd like him to answer why this refusal to use certain terminology to describe certain behavior. And this has been, as Gabe said, part of the administration's policy for a number of years. And my question is, one, why this, I guess, stubbornness to this adherence? And is it working? What's the expected outcome? And you were sharing some insights off air, Gabe. So if you would, please.
Sure. I mean, I think in my book, there's two intended audiences. One is, as the administration likes to say, the world, even though, as you know, we talked about a little bit, it's certainly not monolithic. And the other is the American people. And towards the Muslim world, quote-unquote, I think the issue is that the administration, coming from the top, believed from day one that the reason that we have all these attacks on American, Western, et cetera, targets has to do with the things America says or the things America has done, and that it's a reaction, it's blowback, it's response to Guantanamo Bay, it's a response to the Abu Ghraib scandal, it's a response to the invasion of Iraq, it's a response to all these things. And that if the administration basically tries to demonstrate that it is undoing these policies and that it is not, you know, saying we're not at war with Islam and these sorts of things, that therefore people will be nicer to us or will stop fighting us. In my book, that clearly hasn't worked. In fact, it's gotten worse, and in fact, it encourages it because it means when you can't define something, you don't know what to do about it. If you can't call it for what it is, there's no way you're going to develop a strategy to defeat it.
There was a recent go ahead. Sorry, Gabe.
So I would say the second audience to that, and I think it's equally important, is the American people, which is that, I think the president would prefer that he be able to focus his efforts on domestic politics, whether that's healthcare, immigration, the economy, whatever it may be. And so by trying to change the language that they use, they try to change the focus of the American people. If you don't call it terrorism, if you don't call it radical Islam, if you don't call it these sorts of things, then it doesn't necessarily sink into the psyche of the American people, and they think that, oh, it's okay, the world is actually a safer place, therefore we can focus on the things we want to focus in at home.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, a large part of that Vox, the other highlight of that Vox interview was when he was asked whether he thought that terrorism was kind of overinflated as an issue and whether or not other issues such as the spread of disease and global warming should be more focused on. And his answer to that was absolutely. I think that's the exact answer he said and then kind of went off on a little bit of a tangent. But I think you're right. I think that when it comes to issues, this president feels his expertise is on social and domestic issues and obviously having a little bit of an issue with dealing with foreign policy. Let's go ahead and go to the phone lines. We've got Marilyn on the line. Thanks for calling in, Marilyn.
Oh, Hello. Okay. Your guest there used a phrase about the gymnastics. I forget what the rest of the phrase was, but
linguistic gymnastics,
yeah,
or something,
yeah, like that. Anyways, that was, you know, this president that's perfect for him. I mean, but he can't, if he speaks from his heart, he gets in total trouble because, I mean, so the rest of the time he's pausing, he's talking PC, he's just lying all the time because he can't speak from his heart. And that Jewish deli, I mean, they were, you know, thank God that place wasn't full of Jews that day because they're preparing for the Sabbath the next day, and the Muslims know it, and I'm sure, and, I don't know, Mark Levin said it the other day, really, and I really think this president is an anti-Semite. I truly do. And a lot of the things that your guests are saying are right on, and it's just really scary. This president,
he has.
We could get him out of there because he is not fit to be our president, foreign or domestic. Thank God he doesn't have more time to spend on
that. Marilyn, do you have a question for Gabe?
No, that's it.
Okay, thank you.
Right, thanks for calling in, Gabe. What do you think about that charge that the president's an anti-Semite?
I think that's categorically false. I mean, I don't think criticizing the president's policies when having to do with the Middle East or Israel or whatever is by no way anything close to thinking that the president is anti-Semite. I mean, I think it's pretty preposterous. And even to go back to the caller mentioned the terrorist attack in Paris on the kosher supermarket. I don't know if people remember a smaller story in there, but one of the employees of that market is a gentleman from Mali, a Muslim gentleman from Mali, and he saved a bunch of people in the market by basically helping hide a number of the customers trapped inside in one of the freezers. Yeah. And afterwards was recognized, you know, by the French president and the Malian president. And I mean, it's really an incredible story of heroism in the face of fear right at that moment. So I really don't think that that's where any of these conversations should go.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Chuck. Thanks for calling in, sir.
Yeah, this is one giant game plan with this president we have. He wants to say it a certain way so he can announce he ended the violence in the world. He did this, he did that, when in fact he's just rephrasing it and rewording it and repackaging it. It is just all part of the agenda of the Democratic Party and how they misrepresent reality. And they currently have the news media on their side so they can get away with it, except for the news media is now putting their feet in their mouth.
Well, it's hard. And rocket-propelled grenades in their mouth as well. Thanks for your call, Chuck.
You're welcome.
So what do you think about Chuck's point? I think that he has part of a point, at least. I mean, the president has declared that they ended the war in Iraq and ended with withdrawal in Afghanistan and saw those as opportunities to kind of declare that the job was done, that we had accomplished what we came there to accomplish. And yet, right after we back out, everything kind of goes into a tailspin and we have to go back in. And that doesn't look like success in the eyes of most Americans.
Well, and to drive the point home, just at the end of last week, the administration, security strategy, which is a big 40-page document that's released every 4 years that tries to outline an administration's policy towards the world, and you actually can't find the word victory or win or winning in it. So when it talks about a lot of these conflicts where you have American forces fighting, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or at the time in Libya or the kind of general war on terror, even though we don't call it that, in Somalia and Yemen and elsewhere, the president doesn't talk about what is our strategy for victory. You know, what does that look like? There's no question it would be difficult and costly, and those are costs that I think the American people really need to think about, but it's not even phrased that way. So it's very difficult to be able to say, how do we win if we don't even identify what victory looks like and we don't call our enemy by its real name?
All right, we got to go to another break. It's the last one, and it's only a minute, I promise. We'll be right back. All right, see, we're right back. That didn't take long at all, did it? Very painless. All right, we're back on the Talk Back Show. We've got Gabriel Scheinman on for just a little bit longer, director of the Jewish Policy Center's policy branch, I guess I could say that probably a little bit better. Anyway, Bob why don't you transition us out of the show here? You had something you wanted to get back to before we run out of time.
Sure. I mean, the biggest upshot, and this is why I think Netanyahu is so intent on speaking before Congress and making the case for what he believes elsewhere. But the issue is that, number one, it is concerned that if the United States signs a deal with Iran, it basically is legitimizing an Iranian nuclear capability. And as a consequence, Israel feels like its options get constrained and that it increases the likelihood of an Israeli military action. Combined with the fact that if Israel were to take military action, the diplomatic scenario surrounding it has changed massively from 2 years ago. Israel will be seen as the bad apple. It will be seen as the reason that this whole diplomatic gambit fell apart. And so in many ways, the administration's desire to sign a bad deal with Iran puts a double squeeze on Israel's ability to maintain all options on the table. And I think that's what worries the Israeli prime minister more than anything else.
I wanted to ask you real quickly, there was an instance not too long ago, John Kerry kind of was going off the cuff and described some of the outrage.
Not the
Arab
first time.
yeah. Going off about a lot of the outrage in the Arab world being over Israeli-Palestinian relationships. And I think if we recall when Kerry first took office, the focus was supposed to be Israel and Palestine. I mean, he was trying to make a big play to solve that issue. I wanted to get your take on that. You had mentioned earlier that it's something that's kind of overstated as an issue. What do you think the real issue is?
I mean, the real issue is that there are many issues in the Middle East, and I wouldn't argue that it would be hard to say that there's a single conflict or a single axis around which everything else revolves. But, you know, to be clear, if you simply just look at what's gone on the last few years in the Middle East, none of it has to do with Israel. If you look at the quote-unquote Arab Spring, which you can't really call that anymore, but the sort of tumult that swept through the Arab world, it had nothing to do with Israel. You had people protesting against their own regime for a whole lot of different reasons, toppling a number of them. If you look at the Sunni-Shiite conflict that goes back, you know, over 1,000 years, you know, the words coming out of the mouths of the leaders of Sunni Arab states, whether it's the King of Saudi Arabia or others, when referring to Iran, are almost identical to what Netanyahu and other Israelis say. So there's a whole lot of issues going on here that have nothing to do with where Israel builds apartments in the West Bank or what the Palestinians do about it. In many ways, the Palestinians have actually gotten marginalized as a consequence because you have more and more leaders in the region who say, you know what, you know, I kind of support you guys, empty rhetoric, but I have so many other things to worry about.
So do you think that Kerry and the administration are buying into a false line?
Yeah, I mean, look, I wrote an article a month or two ago called Netanyahu is the Israeli Copernicus. And Copernicus, you know, the Prussian-Polish physicist going back in the 15th century or 16th century, basically was arguing the fact that the
heliocentrism.
Universe did not... Yeah, exactly. The universe did not revolve around the Earth, but everything revolved around the sun. And the Catholic Church argued that everything revolved around the sun. And I was trying to make the parallel that the United States or this administration seems to often say that everything in the Middle East revolves around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And what Netanyahu, Israelis, and even a number of Arab leaders are both saying and doing by their actions is saying no. You know, there's some things that have to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but most do not. Iran is not trying to acquire nuclear weapons because Israelis build synagogues in the West Bank. You know, the Houthis in Yemen didn't take over Yemen because Israelis trying to acquire, build, you know, apartments somewhere in the West Bank. You know, the people of Egypt didn't rebel. You haven't had three Egyptian regimes in the course of 4 years because of anything Israel has to do. So, you know, the administration seems to not quite understand it, and it's colored a lot of their policy.
All right. Gabriel, thank you so much for being with us today. We're almost out of time. Give people a website or an address where they can find out more.
Sure. I mean, our website, the Jewish Policy Center, is www.jewishpolicycenter.org. Pretty straightforward. It's where we publish a lot of our articles, our magazine, and you can contact us through there, and more than happy to send people material, put people on our email list to you know, hear what our views are.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Gabriel, thank you so much for being with the Council.
Thank you for having me.
That's right. It has been a World Affairs Council day, by the way. Thanks again for bringing such great guests to us, Bob. Tomorrow, we'll have a very local discussion about pawn shops and a new law that people are, or a Missoula area policy that people are complaining about as being an infringement on people's Fourth Amendment rights. Should a pawn shop be required to report what sort of item that Bob might choose to pawn or that John might choose to pawn? Pawn, P-A-W-N, yes. Yes, Bob is clearly stuck on the first half hour. I can't get it out of his mind. He's all dressed to go, too. I'm glad you didn't wear your Speedo like Peter did. That's good. All right. We'll be back tomorrow, and more Talk Back on the way. Have a great day.